Audio tape by Greg Kokel is one of the resources of Stand to Reason, an organization committed to training Christians to make a thoughtful defense of their faith and values in the public square. We hope this tape will be helpful. Now, here's Greg Kokel.
On March 27th this year, Americans all over the country awoke to some very stunning headlines. Headlines announcing the suicide deaths of 39 cult members of the Heaven's Gate UFO cult. It was a shocker. In fact, it consumed our thinking for the days that followed as we began to work through the process of how to understand this. And most of the news weeklies had cover stories. In fact, U.S. News and World Report had these words on its cover. And I think when they wrote these words, they actually said quite a bit more than they realized they were saying. It says, "Lost souls. How reasonable people can hold unreasonable beliefs." Now, one other line there identifies this article as pertaining to cult suicides, but it's really quite a good description of our nation as a whole. Lost souls. How reasonable people, intelligent people, rational people can hold very unreasonable beliefs. And as I listened to talk radio the week of this event, in fact, I was interviewed the afternoon of the morning of those headlines. I heard people say all kinds of unusual things. I was surprised to hear Christians, for example, attacking aspects of the cult without realizing unwittingly that they were, in a sense, attacking their own faith. They talked about the bizarre nature of the cult's belief, this idea that they could advance to another form of life, a higher level of life. They could leave these bodies that they described as their containers and go to a new level of existence, a level of existence that brought hope and satisfaction and fulfillment, a kind of desire and fulfillment they always knew was possible but never attained in this life. These people talked about the next step. They talked about angelic beings, disembodied beings. They talked about rescue from this earth. And when you think about that, all of those things are characteristic of a Christian worldview. Paul talks about our bodies being tents that we inhabit, and one day we will throw off this body, and we will be rescued from outer space, as it were, in a manner of speaking, by the second coming of Christ. And he will be accompanied by an angelic host announcing his return. And I was really surprised, and I warned my own radio audience, that we have to be careful how we attack these kinds of groups, because we don't want at the same time to be attacking Christianity unwittingly. It wasn't that these kinds of beliefs themselves were bizarre. Christians hold beliefs like these. The point was that these kinds of beliefs held by these people in these ways were just simply false. They were misled. They were misdirected. And I listened as other Christians would call in and say, "You know what? I want to condemn what they did, but I have to admit for myself that my faith is also the kind of thing that I just believe, and I have no reasons to believe it. Christian faith is unreasonable." And I tell you, friends, I shuddered when I heard that kind of stuff. Because in one way, we were distancing ourselves from the lost souls of the Heaven's Gate cult in a way that was inappropriate, in a way that violated a Christian worldview. And in another way, we were identifying somewhere with this group in a way that also violated a Christian worldview. And what this tells me, unfortunately, is that Christians have not been careful to think clearly about what it means to be a Christian in this culture. How is it that reasonable people can hold unreasonable beliefs? The answer to that is very simple. People don't care about reason anymore. Outside of the church or inside of the church. This is unfortunate when it happens in the world. It is tragic when it happens in Christianity. And unfortunately, in Christian circles, anti-intellectualism has been raised almost to the level of a virtue. And when we do that, we leave the church without defense. We leave the church without capability of speaking clearly to these kinds of things and accurately separating the wheat from the chaff, the truth from the error. And what I'd like to talk about this morning are four particular things, and there could be more, probably are, but four particular things that I think Christians are not thinking clearly on that strike me as vital to the Christian worldview and the health and the influence of the church in this culture. And those things our Christians are seem to be unclear on what faith is. They seem to be unclear on what truth is. They seem to be unclear, amazingly, on what it means to be a Christian. And they also seem to be unclear on what it means to be a human being. In other words, what is it that makes a human being valuable? Let me take each one of those one at a time. First of all, Christians are unclear on what faith is. As I mentioned, as I listened to these radio stations, I heard of people, Christians, who would say, you know, I'm a Christian and I'm kind of like this in the sense that we have these beliefs that can't be substantiated. We just must believe by faith. And some of us think that this is a virtue, that we just make this leap by faith. And in fact, if there was evidence and if there was support for what we believe, then that isn't faith. Well, faith is deeply misunderstood, I think, and Christians are to blame. In fact, I don't like the word faith. It's not that I think there's anything wrong with faith or that faith isn't valuable, but it's often been mischaracterized. Faith is what you use in the minds of many people when all reason fails you. I like the Archie Bunker definition, but when I use this, nobody knows most places who I'm talking about anymore when I mention Archie Bunker from the TV show All in the Family in the 60s and 70s. But Archie Bunker said that faith is believing in things that you'd never believe in unless they were in the Bible. And because they're in the Bible, of course, you've got to believe in them. It's a kind of a religious wishful thinking. When pastors oftentimes tell us to have faith in the face of our doubts, it's almost like squeezing out spiritual hope by intense acts of sheer will. I'm just going to have faith. In spite of all the evidence to the contrary. It means ignoring reality. It means closing our eyes. It means denial is what it turns out to be in the minds of many Christians. And this is why we talk about the leap of faith. We close our eyes and make a leap and believe in something and then hope it's true. Well, I'll tell you something, friends. My Christian life is not an exercise in wishful thinking. And frankly, if I were to wish up anything, I wouldn't wish up Christianity. It's far too inconvenient. People say, well, you're a Christian because you like Christianity. I don't like Christianity. There are all kinds of things about Christianity I would change if I were making the rules. I became a Christian not because I like it, not because God promised to make my life wonderful and give me joy and peace and all that other stuff. Sometimes I don't feel joyful and I don't feel peaceful. That isn't why I became a Christian. I became a Christian because I believed it was true. And if it's not true, there's no sense following it. But Christians seem to feel comfortable with making this leap. Biblical faith is not wishing, ladies and gentlemen, it's knowing. Hebrews 11:1 says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for. It's not just the things hoped for, it's not just the hope, it's the assurance in the hope. It's the conviction or evidence of things not seen. So biblical faith isn't wishing, it's confidence. And what gives us confidence? Well, the evidence gives us confidence. That's why Christianity cares about the evidence. For the Christian, the facts actually matter. And you can't have assurance for something that you don't know you're going to get. You go down to the 7-Eleven or the liquor store or the gas station to get a lottery ticket. How many people get a lottery ticket? Nobody wants to admit it. See, I know you're all lying, see? Some of you go for the big stuff. You want the millions and millions. Do you hope for a winner? Sure, that's why you invested your $5 or whatever it is. But you have no assurance. That's why they call it the lottery. You hope you win, of course. Do you have assurance that you win? Of course not. You have blind faith, mere hope. But what if you happen to know that the numbers that you are about to choose would in fact be the numbers that would come up when the little balls fall into the basket? Would you be hoping? You'd be more than hoping. You would be certain that your hope was well-founded and you would be rewarded. You would have the assurance of that hope for, and your attitude would be very different, wouldn't it? You'd be already spending the money. If you knew for sure, based on some other inside information, that your hope would be fulfilled in actuality and you'd win that lottery. That's the way Christianity is. That's the way biblical faith is. It is not just a blind hope, maybe it'll happen. But it's the assurance of that which we hope for, because the assurance is based in evidence. And that, by the way, is why the resurrection, which we celebrated 2 weeks ago, is so important to Christianity. I had a call yesterday on the radio show. Someone was listening to Marcus Borg on TV. Marcus Borg, one of the leaders of the Jesus Seminar, who deny the historical reliability of the Gospels, especially the resurrection. I think the reasons that they do so are important. People don't understand that it's not the result of historical research that they deny it. It's because of their predisposition not to believe in miracles. And so when they say there is no good evidence for the resurrection, the reason they say that is because there are no resurrections. And if there are no resurrections, how can there be any evidence for such a thing? But Marcus Borg goes on to say that it doesn't really matter because we have the Easter story. We have the myth of new life in the resurrection, and so we can take hope and be encouraged in the story. Well, I don't stand with Marcus Borg. I stand with the Apostle Paul. The resurrection does matter. And when you read 1 Corinthians 15, he says, listen, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, we're liars because we said he did. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead and there is no resurrection, not only was there no resurrection for Christ, there's no resurrection for us. There is no hope for us in the future. There is no leaving this container. There is no better life in the future if Jesus didn't really rise from the dead. What's to hope in? In fact, Paul says, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, we are of most men to be pitied. People should feel sorry for us. If what we're chasing after is just a blind hope, a story that has no substance in reality. But Paul says, no, Jesus has risen from the dead. And because of that historical fact, we can have confidence that our hope will be fulfilled. That's biblical faith. Not wishful thinking. It's assurance founded on evidence. So Christians do themselves a disservice when they try to make faith into some kind of leap that is ungrounded. Because not only is there no defense for the gospel with others, if that's the way we believe about faith, but there is no defense for the gospel against the greatest critic that you will ever face in your life, yourself. And when you wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, wondering if all that you've given your life for is actually not a farce, as many people will tell you it is. You must have more than a blind leap to get back to sleep. And that's the biblical way of viewing faith. So Christians are unclear on what faith is, and that leaves the gospel without a defense. And it undermines their own confidence as Christians. Second, Christians are unclear on what truth is. Truth has always been an issue for the Christian definition of faith. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but through me. And this is why, by the way, faith does not save you. Faith doesn't save you. God saves you through your faith. Many Christians have a blind leap of faith in Jesus. Fortunately for them, their blind leap landed them in the right spot. There are others who have more faith, I guess, in Buddha or Krishna or whatever they're happening to follow than I have in Jesus, but unfortunately they haven't placed their faith well. They haven't placed their faith in what is true. That's the problem with Heaven's Gate. It isn't because they had bizarre beliefs. Christians have bizarre beliefs in the context of our culture. The difference is that the Christian beliefs can be shown and demonstrated to be true and reasonable in light of the evidence, where these beliefs can't be. In fact, back in 1975, I was living in Westwood Village, going to a school called the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse, and many of you who have been with this church for a long time, even at the former location, might remember. And we went to Santa Monica at one point to witness to a group of people, a couple hundred of them actually, who were assembling to hear the testimony of two individuals just simply called the Two. We witnessed outside in the lines, talking to people. We shared Christ with them, and then we went inside for the meeting. And during the meeting, these people, these representatives, explained how there was going to be a time when UFOs, remember this is more than 20 years ago, when UFOs would come and rescue us and take us off to a better life. And I remember so clearly what they said. They said, we offer you no evidence, we offer you no proof, we're not trying to convince you. We are just letting you know. And if you want to go with us, you must leave everything now. And they gave an altar call. And dozens of people came forward. How is it, ladies and gentlemen, that someone could stand up and say, here is our bizarre belief. We give you no evidence. You must leave everything to follow this. And dozens of people come forward. Does this tell you something about the human condition? About the yearning in the human heart for the transcendent? About the hunger they really feel for God? Now, the unfortunate thing is that the two were not the truth. And the leader of that group, and I can't recall for sure whether he was the one who did the presentation or not, was one of the bodies that was in the mansion in Rancho Santa Fe 3 weeks ago. And there was also a body of a woman who in 1975 was a UCLA student. And I often wonder whether I had a chance to talk with that person or not, or one of the other Christians that were assembled there that day to talk with these people, to give them the truth. In a sense, the same message, the message of redemption, of a future with hope, of a getting out of this tent, this package, this container, so that we could advance to a level that we were always meant to attain, but through the person of Jesus, the one, not through the two. Not through aliens on a spaceship, but through God incarnate himself, Jesus Christ. I don't recall anyone made decisions for Christ that day, but the message was there. And you see, by contrast, and this is my point here, the message wasn't just make a leap of faith, but there is no evidence for it. Believe our thing rather than believe their thing. No, the message was this is true, and here are the reasons why. And so truth has been an issue for Christianity, but that's changed, actually, since the Civil War. You know, since the Civil War, there's been a radical change in the face of Christianity in this culture. And it's so different that it's surprising when I think of what it used to be like compared to what it's like now. Back then, information, truth, rationality, reason was a virtue, and it mattered in the church. But you see, Christianity came under attack from philosophy and from German higher criticism of the Bible and from science and Darwinism during that time, and Christians made a serious mistake. Instead of standing to the challenge as they had done for 1800 years and answering the charges, and the charges were to a great degree answered in all those fields, but the church at large said, you know what? The mind doesn't matter that much. I know Jesus is in my heart. I feel him there. That's all that matters to me. And they closed their mind to all the other stuff. And what they did is they created a division now between the mind and the heart, and Christians became the people who just feel about things and just believe about things regardless of the evidence. Christians said the evidence didn't matter. That's what happened. They said you can have all your evidence out there against Christianity. I have my personal belief. And you see, what they did is they planted the seeds for a change in the definition of truth. Because now pretty much the whole country has accepted the notion that what truth is what an individual believes. So therefore, you believe in Jesus, that's, watch this, your truth. I believe in Krishna, that's my truth. And everybody has their truth, and everybody's truth is equal. Nowadays in our culture, that's called tolerance and pluralism. You can't act like your view is right because you've made a serious mistake there. In fact, I run into this, and I used to be a fairly regular guest on Religion on the Line on KBC, in which you have a rabbi and a Roman Catholic priest and a Protestant minister discussing religious issues along with a talk show host. And it was interesting when I got a call on that show about 3 months ago when I was a guest, and the caller basically put the question to each panel member, how do I choose a religion? And it was fascinating for me to hear the rabbi and the priest respond, especially since I had been a Roman Catholic. I was raised that way in the Vatican I tradition, the old school, as it were. And both of them said the same thing. Find something that you like. Find something that resonates with you. Try out a couple of things and see what fits. Do you notice their definition of truth? Their definition of truth is subjective. It is find out what feels good for you. My response was the only response I could give. I said, don't try to find out what fits or what feels good. Find out what's true. In other words, what really fits the world? You don't want to believe in Krishna if Krishna and Hinduism is not an accurate reflection of the way the world really is. You don't want to believe in Buddhism if Buddha didn't accurately describe the world. And by the same token, you don't want to believe in Jesus Christ if he was just another way, another thing to do. But truth has fallen on hard times. And tragically, Christians don't know the difference. And this is why I was just reading some information from George Barna, who's the religious pollster here in this country. And in 1991, 67% of Americans agreed with the statement that there is no such thing as an absolute truth. In other words, two people can believe contradictory things and both be right. And you could believe that Jesus is Messiah, and you could believe that he's not Messiah, and you're both right. What is that? That's a view of truth, that things are true only for people who believe them. And in 1991, 67% of Americans believed that. By 1994, 72% of Americans believed that. Now, we expect that among the unchurched, so to speak. But what's ironic, what's tragic, is that in 1991, more than half, 52% of born-again Christians held the same view. And in 1994, 62% did. Guess what? What those statistics show is that the percentage who reject absolute truth is growing faster among Christians than among our secular neighbors. How can that be? What does it mean to be a Christian if you reject the notion that truth is true? To put it simply, or as Dr. Francis Schaeffer put it, true truth. I guess this is the same survey that when surveying evangelicals, 95% of evangelicals believed in God. And what's wrong with that statistic, ladies and gentlemen? What happened to the other 5%? And so Christians are not just confused on the nature of faith, as if faith is just wishful thinking. They are also confused now on the nature of truth, and they hold the same view as the world, by and large, and increasingly so, and more so. When Christians ought to be the ones that are standing firm on solid ground, offering a light to the rest of the world so that they could follow the truth in Jesus Christ, instead we are saying not that Jesus is the way. We are saying, well, Jesus is a way. I follow him. Try him, you'll like him. If you don't like him, try someone else. That's not the message of the apostles. And by the way, it makes me wonder whether those 64% who hold that view can possibly genuinely call themselves Christians. And this leads to my next point, that Christians are confused on what it means to be a Christian. Someone told me the other day, they called me actually, asked a question. They said, what should be done about a president of a Baptist college in the Midwest, I don't remember who it was, they didn't tell me, who didn't believe that Jesus was the only way? I have a hard time understanding how that person could genuinely be a Christian. Why would I believe in Jesus? Well, it seems to me that the reason you should believe in Jesus is because he does something for you that needs to be done. He provides forgiveness of sins. Now, if he doesn't in fact provide forgiveness of sins, well, then it's just a game. It's a charade. Why mess with Jesus? Why not go into New Age religion, which is very high on individual freedom and low on personal responsibility? That's more fun, frankly. Why mess with Jesus? But see, if Jesus does in fact forgive sins, it's not just a view I hold because I like it, but if the fact is that I'm a sinner and that I owe God obedience and I violated his law and I stand under his judgment, then I need rescue. And I turn to Christ and I say, rescue me. Save me. And then because of what he did on the cross, he does save me. Now, if that's really the fact of the matter, and that's what it means for me to be a Christian, what does that mean for those who don't have Jesus as their Savior? Who don't have Jesus as their rescuer? Doesn't it mean that they are not rescued? Doesn't it mean that they are not saved? Doesn't it mean that that which Jesus does for me, he doesn't do for them? Doesn't that mean they are then still in their sins? Doesn't that mean then if they are still in their sins, they must stand before God and be judged for those sins? Buddha didn't die for sins. Krishna didn't die for sins. Muhammad didn't die for sins. Jesus died for sins. And you see, this is a stunning point of confusion. I know Christians don't understand really what it means to be Christian when I see the way they respond to these kinds of things. I ask them, why is Jesus the only way? Because he said so? Well, that's a good start. But he said so for a good reason. I'm stunned that someone can't answer that, but it's amazing. 9 out of 10 Christians that I talk to can't answer that well. The reason Jesus is the only way is because he's the only one who solved the problem. The problem is sin. He solved the problem, therefore he provided access to the Father. No one else did what he did. And you see, when we're not clear on this, then we get objections from very fine thinkers and human beings like Dennis Prager, who broadcasts in this city, who says, I don't get it about Christianity. It seems like God is more interested in belief in what seems to be minor details of theology, Jesus being the Son of God and the Savior, than he is with conduct. Where from his perspective, when he hears Christians talk about Christianity, it sounds like you can do anything you want, behave any way you want, as long as you believe the right things about Jesus. Then you're in. Well, that sounds ludicrous to him. Well, the way it's presented by Christians, it is ludicrous. Ladies and gentlemen, we don't go to hell because we don't believe in Jesus. Let me say that again. We do not go to hell because we don't believe in Jesus. Revelations chapter 20, we see a description of the great white throne judgment. People are judged there. What are they judged by? Is there any mention of belief in Jesus there? No, not at all. The books are open. They're judged according to what? Their deeds. God is like any righteous judge. He sends people into judgment because of violations of his law. Now, Jesus is the antidote. He will rescue you from that judgment because he took the judgment himself. But he isn't the problem. And so God's not just picky about details of theology, like, well, you've got to get this one little thing right. I remember when I was at UCLA, back there in the Light and Powerhouse days, back when I was spreading a little bit more heat than light, I'm afraid, some college student came up to me after we'd shown a film and had some discussion afterwards about Christianity, and I explained these things to him, and he said to me, you know, if God's the kind of guy who won't let me into his heaven just because I won't believe in his son, then I don't want to spend eternity with him. Now, this course got me quite excited. I made a bit of a scene. But now I understand his objection, because the way I was explaining it, it sounded like God's fussing over little details of theology. Instead of saying, listen, everybody is guilty before God. You have a choice. You can be forgiven by Jesus who paid your debt, or you can stand before God in your own guilt. It's up to you. That's the issue. We're guilty. Now, do you want forgiveness or not? If you don't, then you pay. You see, that sheds a different light on Jesus being the only way, doesn't it? It's not just a picky thing about some theological detail. It's the very foundation itself, our guilt, and the requirement of our forgiveness, and the opportunity of forgiveness through Jesus Christ. I was reading in Time magazine, a month ago, they had articles on, a cover story on heaven. In fact, somebody was so frustrated with the continuous articles in these news weeklies, Time and U.S. News and World Report, among them, on religious themes. Seems like every time you turn around, there it is, a cover story. This country is getting very religious, at least in one sense. Person writes and says, why don't you just change your name to Christianity Today, you know? But Trish Carr, writing from Portland, Oregon, says this. Excellent topic. Does heaven exist? I am a devout Christian, she says. And I don't give much thought to heaven. Now, that struck me as odd to begin with. My spirituality isn't based on an anthropomorphic kick-butt God who will throw four generations of children into eternal damnation because some distant forefather ticked him off. That sounds Christian. Heaven is the flip side of the absolutely barbaric notion of hell that evolved under that kick-butt mindset. Hell is just plain inconsistent with the tradition of mysticism that brought me into the faith in the first place. To me, God is a symbol for something unfathomable, an utter mystery that fills my heart with joy and my spirit with song. This person starts out by saying she's a Christian. Well, I don't know what she is, but she's not a Christian. I'm not saying she's a nasty person or she's awful or... at this point, I'm not even saying that her view is false. It's just not what Christianity is. She doesn't understand that. A lot of people don't understand that. This is very in keeping with a leap of faith mentality. And it is very much in keeping with the idea that truth is whatever you happen to believe. This is her truth. She can make up her own Christianity. And ladies and gentlemen, when we make up our own Christianity, when we twist it out of its historical shape, we lose its historical significance and its historical impact. It no longer is what it was meant to be, and therefore it can no longer do what it was meant to do. Can this Christian go to heaven? How can she? She doesn't believe in heaven, nor does she believe in hell, and I bet she doesn't even believe in sin, from what she said so far. Then what does it mean to be a Christian, a follower of Jesus Christ who forgives sin if there is no sin? Why follow Jesus anyway? So Christians are not just confused about what faith is and about what truth is, but they're also confused about what it means to be a Christian. Now, finally, Christians, I think, are unclear on what it means to be human. This is a little different than the other objections that I've had. This is really the ethical question. And we fuss appropriately about, maybe that's too mild a word, frankly, about abortion and infanticide and doctor-assisted suicide and homosexual marriage, and more recently about cloning. But I am not at all convinced that Christians have a clear understanding from a Christian worldview about what it means to be human that will give an anchor to these objections and will guide their objections. It's most notably apparent to me in the cloning issue. I was really stunned as I listened to Christians respond when old Dolly, the lamb, or as Bobby the Bouncer, my board engineer, calls Dolly Lama, the clone lamb, that whole thing became public. And Christians would say things like, what about cloning human beings? Of course, that was the issue when it turned out that this high-level mammal was cloned, the first creature without first mammal without an actual father. I mean, it was an unusual, and it was a twin, a time delay twin, so to speak, because its twin was years older. Its genetic twin was years older. By the way, that's what a clone is. If you're wondering how to think about clones, just think of clones as twins. That is all they are. A clone is a twin. And the different types of cloning may follow different procedures. The early ones in 1993 just mimic the twinning process when an egg splits and you have two individuals with the same genetic code. What was done with Dolly the llama was a little different, but it still resulted in the same thing, a genetic twin that was time delayed. But think of a clone like a twin. And I listened, and in fact, I was reading People magazine. And I saw a comment by a very well-known head of a bioethics and human dignity center, Christian, academic, and he said this, part of our notion of human dignity is that we are different. With that, I agree. And then he added this, cloning of humans diminishes the dignity in all of us. And I thought, what kind of statement is that for this man to make, being a Christian? I'll tell you why I said that. It is true that what makes human beings valuable is their distinctiveness, but it is not true that that distinctiveness is something that resides in the physical body. We are not physicalists. We don't believe that the human body is all that there is, such that if you reproduce the human body to make an exact copy, then you've lost the distinctive value of that original. We believe that there's more to being human than just having a body. In fact, the source of being human is not in the body, but in the soul. The body is worn by the soul, as it were. The soul is what makes us human. The soul is what makes us valuable. And it isn't just having a soul, because animals have souls as well. This is the classic teaching of the church. There's good reasons to believe that, biblically and otherwise. It is not that we have a soul, but the kind of soul that we have. What kind of soul do we have? A soul that bears the imprint of God. And people have said, they're all confused. Well, if we do this cloning and we allow this, I could just clone myself and farm my clone for parts, body parts. We can clone ourselves and make a whole race of clones and then use them for slaves. I said, you could already do that. It's called parenthood. Why can't we farm our children for body parts? Why can't we use them for slaves? Ladies and gentlemen, it has nothing to do with the way they were conceived. Nothing at all. It has everything to do with the kind of creatures they are. They are human beings who bear the imprint of God in some powerful, valuable way. And this applies to everything of end-of-life decisions and how we treat human beings. Ellen DeGeneres, the actress on the show Ellen, just came out, as it were, as a homosexual. As it turns out, in her part on the show, she is also coming out as a homosexual in the character she plays. Some Christian leaders have referred to her as Ellen Degenerate. Well, I personally happen to believe, as a matter of moral description, that homosexuality is degenerate. But it's wrong to refer to Ellen Degeneres in that way. Just as it's wrong to refer to homosexuals as faggots and fairies. Why? Because that demeans them as human beings, and regardless of their conduct, they are still human beings that are made in the image of God. And because they are made in the image of God, there are certain moral obligations that obtain with regards to our behavior to them. We treat them in a certain way. We don't have the liberty, if we're consistent Christians, to treat people we don't like in a dehumanizing way. If we're consistent Christians, we can speak against the immorality, but we must also act in a way that reflects the dignity they have as God's image bearers. And you see, when we're confused of what makes human beings valuable, we do foolish things like condemn homosexuality, which is not foolish, but in the next breath, dehumanize the homosexual. That's sin, ladies and gentlemen. We argue for the life of the unborn, but then we are unclear on why that unborn's life is valuable. And so that's why we might say, as some would, you know, I'm personally against abortion, but I don't think we should legislate against it. I always ask a question when that statement comes up, and you ask the same question. It's a very simple question when you hear somebody say that. You say, why are you against it? I did this with a man at a Ligonier conference in Florida a couple of years ago. He said, I'm personally against it, but I don't want it outlawed. And I said, well, why are you personally against it? And he gave me the most common response. I think it kills an innocent human child. I said, let me see if I've got this right then. You think that abortion kills an innocent human child, but you think that women should be allowed to do that. He said, well, when you put it that way. I said, put it what way? That's your view. If I've misrepresented you in some fashion, please let me know. You see, I can't hold the view that abortion is wrong, but that it's okay for other people to do it, because I understand what makes human beings valuable. It's not just wrong for me. It's not just that I don't like abortion. People say, you don't like abortion? Don't have one. You miss the point. I'm not saying I don't like it. My truth is not subjective in this sense. I'm saying that human beings are the kinds of beings in themselves that ought not to be killed for frivolous reasons, whether I like it or not. But you see, I could say that because I understand biblically what it means to be human, what makes human beings valuable. And this is why I'm offended by abortion of all kinds, except for when two valuable human lives are in conflict. One is going to be lost one way or another. You see, that's consistent with my view. And that's why I'm against doctor-assisted suicide. We don't own our bodies. We don't own ourselves. We bear God's imprint. We belong to Him. We can't take our own lives. They don't belong to us. They are not our property that we can do anything with. This is why I'm against abortion. This is why I'm in favor of cloning per se. It doesn't bother me that people are cloned. I don't care how human beings happen to be assembled. If they're human beings, then they bear God's image. That's the way they're made. Now, I think that there is a danger in cloning, and it's how human beings may be treated who are cloned. They may be treated as if they're just the product, assembly of a scientist, as if they're just someone's property, and that, of course, would violate the image of God there. And I hope you're beginning to see how Christians' clear thinking on a couple of very fundamental issues, on faith, on truth, on what it means to be a Christian, on what it means to be human, become foundational for virtually everything else in their life. Certainly the substance of their evangelism. Certainly the substance of their ethical involvement in their culture. And in fact, if you don't have this kind of foundation, if you're unclear on this, you can't make that impact. I mean, let me ask you a question in closing here. If we as Christians are unclear on what faith is, if we're unclear on what truth is, if we're unclear on what a Christian is, if we're unclear on what makes a human being valuable, what do we have to say? What message do we communicate? We have nothing to say. You've just got a personal story to tell that might be nice. This is my experience. We're no different from anyone else. Because Christians are not thinking clearly on what faith is, the gospel is left without defense and knowledge is reduced to mere belief. When knowledge is reduced to mere belief, then truth becomes not a statement about the world out there, but a statement about our feelings, reducing Christianity to sentimentalism and subjectivity. And this leads to two problems. The word Christian becomes putty. It can be made to mean anything, and therefore it means, if it means anything and everything, it actually means nothing. The salt has lost its saltiness. And also the concept of human value becomes putty, and we can define human value any way we want. If we fall prey to this, ladies and gentlemen, what do we have to say? What do we have to say to our culture? What is our message? I think Paul's final warning and exhortation to Timothy is no less relevant today than it was then. Let me read it to you. Paul, in the last days of his life, penned these final words to his charge, Timothy. He says, I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by his appearing and his kingdom, preach the word.
Be ready in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine. But wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and will turn away their ears from the truth, and will turn aside to myths. He said, you, Timothy, be sober. Endure hardship. Do the work of an evangelist. Fulfill your ministry. That's our encouragement for the church today, ladies and gentlemen. It's very simple. It's right there. And I hope that if we fulfill this properly, we could also end our own lives with the same words that Paul ended his. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. In the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who loved his appearing. I want to be counted in that number, and I want to be counted faithful, and I hope you do too. Let's close. Dear Lord, thank you so much for the encouragement of your servant, Paul. Father, I pray that you would help this congregation, the church, myself, Lord, to be clear on the truth, to apply it consistently in my life, to speak it graciously but incisively and effectively, and that in all things we might be faithful, so that on that final day you can say, well done, good and faithful servant. May it be so, Lord. Amen.
For more Stand to Reason tapes or resources, contact the store where you purchased this tape, or call toll-free 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-273-2766.